on the front porch the trials of a Red Sox fan.
I was vastly amused and sympathetic, too. Some people with their hands together actually praying that the Red Sox would win. I think you almost have to be a member of Red Sox Nation to understand that.
This is The Front Porch on NHPR. I'm John Walters. For some Red Sox fans, prayer is a valid response to the team's long championship drought. But if you're a novelist, you don't have to wait for the Sox to win. You can write your own happy ending. That's what Howard Frank Mosier has done in his new book, Waiting for Teddy Williams. It's the story of a teenager from a small town in Vermont's Northeast Kingdom who comes out of nowhere to pitch for the Red Sox in the World Series. It's also the story of life in the kingdom where Howard has made his home for the past 40 years. Howard is here to talk about the Red Sox of fact and fiction, his new novel, and the unique character of the Northeast Kingdom. And we have copies of Waiting for Teddy Williams for people who call with a pledge to NHPR during the show. Howard, welcome to The Front Porch.
Well, thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Sports are often dismissed by intellectual types, but the Red Sox seem to be an exception. A lot of writers and academics are avid Red Sox fans. Why is that?
Well, I think that writers, above all other people, know what it is like to hope and fail and hope again and fail again. I remember when I sent out my first short story to a magazine 40 years ago. It came back. I sent it out again. And I think I stopped counting after I had gotten 60 rejections. And only when I had published my first novel, Disappearances, was I able to get a magazine to take that story. So
you could almost hear the voices in your head chanting whatever the writerly equivalent of 1918 would be.
Yes, that's exactly right. I think that, too, faith in the Red Sox, like any faith, there's a large element of doubt involved in that. And I know in my heart that now on the eve of the World Series, the Red Sox are going to win that World Series. But my head sometimes tells me something else, particularly when I think about Curt Schilling's injury.
And I suppose even when the Red Sox led the Yankees 8-1 in Game 7, there was still that doubt in the back of your mind.
Yes, Joe Buck, the Fox commentator, said, and I was vastly amused by this, there is not a man, woman, or child in Red Sox Nation who feels comfortable with this lead. And I certainly didn't.
Do you talk baseball with other writers?
Oh, yes. It's recently, since the Red Sox have been making their big push, it's about all we've been talking about. Some of my writer friends are, much as I hate to say this, Yankee fans, and we've had some very vigorous discussions over the years. But most of the writers in New England are dyed-in-the-wool Red Sox fans, just as I am and have been nearly all my life.
I understand you actually grew up in upstate New York. Were you ever a Yankee fan?
I was originally. My dad was a Yankee fan, and when I was very young, my dad and my uncle would take me and my dad's old DeSoto up on top of the mountain behind our house to listen to the Red Sox and Yankee games because there was no radio reception in the little mountain village where we lived. And my dad was a very avid Yankee fan. My uncle was an avid Red Sox fan, and they would begin to argue. And they would become so agitated that instead of speaking to each other directly, they'd argue through me. And my dad would say, "Howard, you tell your uncle that Joe DiMaggio is the most complete player in the history of the game." And my uncle, who was sitting 3 feet away from my dad in the front seat of the old DeSoto, would say, "Maybe so, Howard, but you tell your dad that Ted Williams is the best hitter in the history of the game." And this would go on until we lost reception altogether and drove down off the mountaintop in a terrible silence. And as a little kid, I was both a little uneasy to hear adults argue this way and also delighted by it. When I moved to northern Vermont in 1964, I quickly became a Red Sox fan out of necessity. Everyone in the town of Irisburg, where I live, is a Red Sox fan.
Your book is a fantasy about the Red Sox finally winning the World Series after all these years. Will it be out of date if they actually win this year?
Well, that's a good question. I've wondered that, and I think the answer is just as unpredictable as whether they will win this year. I just don't know. I know that last year, when I had finished the book, but it was scheduled for publication this year. My great fear was that the Sox might actually win the series and upstage the book. But I was deeply conflicted. Here I was, a Red Sox fan of 40 years, but rooting against the Red Sox last summer because I thought if they actually won the series in 2003, who would care anything at all about a novel in which they won the series.
Well, I suppose it's a sort of a uniquely Red Sox fan kind of dilemma for you to be professionally rooting against the team and personally, I'm sure, pulling for them.
It certainly was. Although when I asked my wife a couple of nights ago, just before the final game in Yankee Stadium, what would be worse, the Sox losing that game or getting to the World Series and losing? She said, I think for Red Sox Nation, what would be worst of all is getting to the World Series and winning.
Now what do we do? So on the eve of the World Series, what do you think? Can they win?
Oh, I think they can. I think they have great momentum going right now and a wonderful spirit in the clubhouse and in the dugout. I think a lot of it comes down to whether Curt Schilling can be 90% effective. Mm-hmm. I don't think he needs to be 100% effective, but he needs to be 90 or 95% effective, I think, for the Red Sox to do it. But, yes, I think that they can.
That whole thing with Schilling's tendon being sutured in place and the bloody sock and all that, that's almost good enough to come out of a novel like yours.
Oh, it really is. I was astounded that he was able to bear up and pitch as many innings as he did in the seventh game against the Yankees. And I was also vastly amused and sympathetic, too, of the panning shots of the crowd. Some people with their hands together up in Fenway Park a couple of nights before actually praying that the Red Sox would win. I think you almost have to be a member of Red Sox Nation to understand that.
So how'd you come up with the idea for your new novel, Waiting for Teddy Williams?
It came to me in an entirely different way from any other book. And I can tell you how this happened, but I can't really account for it. In the fall of 1999, I was driving in probably the least inspiring place on the face of the earth, the New York State Thruway between Buffalo and Rochester. It was very early in the morning. It was foggy, not entirely light. And suddenly, a picture came into my mind of a little boy looking out of a farmhouse window. Across the barnyard and leaning against the barn was a tall young man wearing a Red Sox cap who looked a little bit like the great Boston Red Sox hitter Ted Williams. And all this came and went in just a second or two. And truth to tell, I was probably too tired to be driving a car at the time. I was coming back from a book tour on the West Coast and pushing hard to get home to Vermont by evening. But because this was so unusual, I stopped at Batavia and went into the nearest McDonald's, ordered a cup of coffee, and in the next 5 minutes, I outlined all of Waiting for Teddy Williams, right down to the main events of the book, the main characters, and I think the title even came to me at the time. 2 years later, when I began working on Teddy, the story changed hardly at all from that outline that I did in Batavia. So go figure. Also for me, my memories of baseball and family are inseparable because baseball was so important to my dad and my uncle. And that must have all been in the back of my mind someplace, but how it ever manifested itself in that image, I will never know.
The idea for the book came to you all at once in a McDonald's along the New York Thruway. Did you have a lot of fun writing this book?
It was a world of fun. I perceived it right from the start as a comic novel and certainly as something of a fantasy, although it may turn out not to be entirely. When I told my wife that I thought I might be writing a fantasy early on and in the composition of the book, she asked me why, and I said, well, there's a talking statue in the book, and the statue talks to the little boy who is the hero of the book. And I think my wife felt I did not want to write a fantasy, because she said that doesn't necessarily make it a fantasy. All kids have imaginary companions. And so I told her about the talking macaw, and she told me that she has a friend who's a talking macaw with a vocabulary of several dozen words. So I said to her, well, I have to tell you that I am thinking in this book also about having the Boston Red Sox win their first World Series since 1918. And you can see where I'm going with this. When I said that, my wife said, congratulations. If the Red Sox win the World Series in this book, you will have written a true fantasy. So, spoken like a long-suffering member of Red Sox Nation, but here on the eve of the World Series, who knows? It's almost as though life is imitating fiction in some very strange way.
Writing a fantasy, do you worry about being taken seriously by serious readers or by critics or literary types?
I do to some extent. My books have always had a pretty strong element of magic realism in them. When I was writing my first novel, Disappearances, which is full of all kinds of supernatural events, I was reading the wonderful South American magical realist Gabriel Garcia Marquez, and I had also started to read the Polish writer, Isaac Bashevis Singer, who loves the supernatural. And ever since then, there's been more than a touch of the supernatural and the fantastical in my books. So I don't think that the talking statue would surprise anyone who's read Disappearances or some of my other books.
Your book is full of real characters, and to me, the Northeast Kingdom itself is a character. Could you talk about the kingdom for those who don't live there, maybe haven't experienced it firsthand?
Well, the Northeast Kingdom is a rather remote part of Vermont. Technically, it consists of Orleans, Essex, and Caledonia counties in northeasternmost Vermont. It's surrounded by mountains, backed up against the Canadian border. And when I moved there in 1964, it was really something of a northern New England frontier. And I immediately realized, as a aspiring storyteller, that I had found a gold mine. Our first landlady in the Northeast Kingdom had saved her farm during Prohibition and the Depression era by manufacturing moonshine and selling it to the villagers. So the kingdom was full of very just extraordinary individualists who had hard scrabble and difficult lives, but whom I found wonderfully admirable, and best of all had stories to tell that no one had ever told before.
The young hero of the book is named E.A., which is short for Ethan Allen, the greatest hero in Vermont's history. Why that name?
Well, I had some fun with E.A. because the talking statue on the common or central green of the village I call Kingdom Common, where E.A. Lives, is in fact little Ethan's great-great-great-great-great-grandfather, the Revolutionary War hero Ethan Allen. And I've always been fascinated by Ethan Allen because the historian suggests that he was a strong individualist in the same tradition as some of the people that I've written about in northern Vermont. And so I wanted to have some fun with this. You mentioned that you thought I might have had fun writing Teddy Williams, and I certainly did. The statue gives E.A. some advice, and some of it is very sound advice, but the statue is also a confirmed member of Red Sox Nation, and as such, the statue conducts a kind of love-hate relationship with the Boston Red Sox, and quite often the topic of discussion between E.A. and his ancestor is the Red Sox. I was vastly amused by the idea of Ethan Allen in the incarnation of a statue being a Red Sox fan, but somehow, in an odd way, it all made sense to me.
And a young Ethan Allen coming down out of the mountains and rescuing the Red Sox, and the name of the town being Kingdom Common. This is sort of full of the writer having a lot of fun.
Absolutely. E.A. has some things in common with his ancestor. He's He's definitely a wrong side of the tracks kid. He's being brought up by his single mom, Gypsy Lee, who's an aspiring country singer, among other somewhat more risque professions. And he doesn't know who his father is, at least at the beginning of the story. And he has two dreams. One is to play baseball for the Boston Red Sox, but the other is to find out who his dad is. All he knows is that in the family cemetery behind the rundown farmhouse where he and Gypsy and Gran live, there is a wooden marker, and on it his mom has scrawled, "Gone and long forgotten." That's all he knows about his father. So he senses that everyone in the town, including the statue of his ancestor, Colonel Ethan Allen, knows who his dad is, but won't tell him. This is something that only his mom can tell him.
And the father figure is named Teddy Williams.
The father figure is named Teddy Williams. No connection to the great Boston Red Sox hitter, Teddy Williams, except that he, too, is a very fine baseball player and very sharp-edged, but too self-destructive ever to have done anything with his baseball. Teddy Williams was inspired by the character leaning against the barn door and that strange image that flashed through my mind. And he shows up when Ethan is 8 years old to do the one decent thing he's ever really done in his life, and that is show this little boy how to play baseball.
The liveliest character in the book is definitely EA's mother, Gypsy, in spite of her shortcomings, I think. She certainly has her own unique moral code, her own take on right, wrong, and family values.
She does. Despite her somewhat risque profession, I think a very good mom. She goes out and pitches EA batting practice behind the house. She's homeschooling him, and one of the things that she likes best to do is to read the classics to EA. EA has some reservations about some of the classics, particularly Pride and Prejudice, but
at the end of the book, Gypsy is headed off to Nashville to try to break into country music. Might there be a sequel about her?
Well, it's possible that that this is what I will do. I don't like to bring major characters back in subsequent books as major characters, but you've given me an idea, and I might mention in passing in another book what becomes of Gypsy Lee. In fact, I'm fairly sure I will. Thank you. That hadn't occurred to me until you mentioned it. It's a good idea.
Have somebody turn on the country music station and hear Gypsy Lee singing on the radio.
Exactly right.
Well, Howard, thank you very much for coming in today.
Well, thank you. It's been fun. Thank you for your good questions.
Howard Frank Mosier, novelist from Vermont's Northeast Kingdom. His books include Where the Rivers Flow North and A Stranger in the Kingdom. His latest novel is Waiting for Teddy Williams, a story of baseball and redemption in Red Sox Nation.